Well, Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing in the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you of the views that are expressed here and not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views, the views of our guests. And, well, this evening our guest is you out there in the listening audience. This is Open Line Wednesday, and we invite your calls at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. So we'd like to know if you have any questions or comments, or you agree or disagree with what I'm going to say. And so I thought I'd start out this evening by talking about Vietnam. Now, why does anybody want to worry about Vietnam? That was 35 years ago. But, of course, you can't understand what's going on in the Middle East today unless you understand the betrayal of our troops in Vietnam. There's a wonderful book. It's called Cheers and Tears. And it actually goes into the background of what happened in 1965 when the members of the Joint Chiefs of Staff went to see President Johnson and told him what needed to be done to win the war. And of course, to win the war, why, you attacked North Vietnam. You cut off their supplies, you cut off their electricity, you do all the things, you bomb the dikes, you attack North Vietnam. And Johnson listened to what the head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff said, and all the rest of the Joint Chiefs of Staff were there. And when he finished, Johnson started yelling and screaming and foaming at the mouth, and as the author of the book, Cheers and Tears, said, as a military officer, as a Marine, he had never heard such vile language from anyone. And the fact that the members of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, these generals, stood there and took it and said, yes, sir, instead of resigning en masse, simply shows the cowardice on the part of the military generals in Vietnam and why we lost the war. They didn't lose militarily. They did fine. Our boys fought very bravely. We won the war many times, but we were never allowed to defeat the enemy. And I personally talked to Ambassador William H. Sullivan, the ambassador to Laos, and to four-star general Lew Walt. Both of them told me we could have won the war at any time in 2 months. We were never allowed to. And the same thing is going on in Iraq today and in Afghanistan. We've been fighting in Afghanistan for 6 years. We've been fighting in Iraq for 4 years, and our military has never been allowed to win the war. They were never given adequate troops. They were never allowed to do what was really necessary. They were just sent over there to fight and bleed and suffer and die, but never to win. And if you doubt this, understand that the major force, you know, behind Al-Qaeda, the Al-Qaeda forces in Iraq, are Saudi Arabia. And Saudi Arabians are on excellent terms with the Bush family. And Saudi Arabia always keeps saying, we're going to do something about it. The majority of the Al-Qaeda fighters come from Saudi Arabia. The funding for Al-Qaeda comes from Saudi Arabia. In fact, 15 of the original 19 hijackers that attacked America came from Saudi Arabia. And what do? Why, we reward them and support them. And of course, it's exactly the same thing as far as Afghanistan is concerned, where we finance the Pakistanis, and the Pakistanis finance their military, and their military supports their intelligence, ISI, and the ISI finances the Taliban that is killing our boys in the poppy fields and villages of Afghanistan. When are the American people going to wake up and realize it's deja vu all over again, it's Vietnam all over again? We're not trying to win the war, and to support the boys, you get them out of there, because the people who control our government have no intention of winning. Well, right now, of course, we have open lines. Our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, and we've got Tom calling from Wyoming about Congressman Ron Paul. Hi, Tom. Do you have a question or comment?
Yes, Dan. Wyoming is having their precinct caucuses this week, and I'd like to put out some information so any listener from Wyoming will be sure to go to their county precinct conventions and vote for Ron Paul.
All right, fine. Well, we cannot support any of the candidates simply because of the FCC restrictions. But if you want to go ahead and talk about Ron Paul, you go right ahead.
Okay. Yes. Well, this week, the precinct caucuses are being held, and they're very important for selecting the state delegate to the state convention in Rock Springs in May. So if Ron Paul is going to win the state of Wyoming, all the Ron Paul supporters who are GOP registered need to make sure that this week they get to their respective county caucuses, precinct caucuses, and vote. They run from this week all the way to the 21st of December.
All right, fine. I appreciate your mentioning that, and I assume then that you are a Ron Paul supporter.
You betcha, Stan. And by the way, I've been dumping all my money into Paul's campaign lately and neglecting you, but I plan on returning to supporting you in force here this next year.
All right. God bless you. We'll appreciate that, Tom.
And okay, thanks, Dan.
And I just want to, I think it's so important that people are involved in the political process, that if we hope to maintain America, we're going to have to be involved. And, Chris, I can't tell people how to vote, and I wouldn't do that, but I certainly, if you listen to my other programs, you'll know how I feel very strongly. But on this program and this network, while we are restricted by FCC regulations from supporting any one specific candidate, but these certainly are exciting times, aren't they, Tom?
They sure are, Stan. And I appreciate everything that you've done for the cause of liberty, too.
Well, we'll keep doing it as long as God gives us the breath and the ability. So God bless it. Thanks very much for calling.
Thank you, Stan.
Bye-bye. Okay, fine. And of course, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. And we started out talking about Vietnam. We were never allowed to win in Vietnam. I mean, what would you have done to win? Why, you would have blockaded the port of Haiphong so that the Viet Cong could not get the supplies that were coming from Russia. Of course, we were financing Russia. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295, and this is Open Line Wednesday. And we were just talking about Vietnam. And, of course, we never tried to win the war in Vietnam. You must understand that. You must understand that all during the war, while the United States government and American corporations were funding the Russian communists, who were funding the North Vietnamese communists, we're funding the Viet Cong, we're killing our boys in the rice paddies and villages of South Vietnam. And, of course, what could have been done to have ended the war? Well, the first thing you would have done would have been to have blockaded or mined the port of Haiphong. First of all, there was a very narrow entrance to Haiphong. You could have sunk a ship there, as the French had done, and then ships couldn't have come in. And, of course, all the supplies, most of the supplies were coming from Russia by ships. Incidentally, most of those ships were built by using American engines or American specifications. And this is covered very well in Professor Sutton's excellent talk and in his book, The Best Enemies Money Could Buy. But he also gave a talk to the Republican convention in 1992, Republican Presidential Convention, and we reproduce that talk in its entirety in a little pamphlet we offer called The Communist Capitalist Alliance. Because most people have to really understand is that the United States and the Federal Reserve and American corporations have funded communism going back to 1918. But we can't let the American people know that. Supposedly the communists are wicked and they're our enemies. Well, the communists are wicked, but they're not our enemies. They're not the enemies of the people who really run things. They wanted an enemy so they could justify a massive military and taxation And so they could point to the enemy and saying, you've got to rally behind us because we're going to protect you from those wicked communists. And so this is, of course, if you go into the background of the Russian Revolution and its aftermath and why you find out that the United States did everything they could to help them. A massive starvation all throughout Russia immediately after the First World War. Massive aid from the United States. 97% of the communists, 3% of the anti-communists. You honestly believe that that happened just by accident? This is covered, of course, in Herbert Hoover's memoirs. We can send you the page from his memoirs where it shows how 97% of the supplies that were sent by the United States, the humanitarian supplies, were sent to Russia to the communists and 3% to the anti-communists. Actually, we cover that very well in my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, and then the stories of the various resistance groups, those who were trying to oppose communism, and how under each one of them was undercut by the American or the British government. Understand, we created the best enemies money could buy. And as we point out in our little pamphlet, the Communist-Capitalist Alliance, Russia went from a bankrupt nation 10 years ago where she could not even meet her international obligations and had to default on her loans, to the largest exporter of both oil and natural gas in the world today, with some of the largest reserves. I mean, the Russians have over $440 billion in reserves. We don't have reserves like that. Mainly because we've been transferring so much money over to Russia, and we are still doing it. Why would you do that when America has to borrow $2 billion a day just to meet our debts, and you're still funding the Soviet Union? Why, we've created the best enemy money could buy. Well, let's go to Herman, who's calling from the Carmel area, and again, our number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. Hey, Herman, how are you doing?
Fine, Doctor. I was around in the 60s and 70s, and I remember the fear that the Cold War engendered in people, and you mentioned that all America would have had to do is to mine the port of Haiphong and stop the supplies coming in from Russia, but wouldn't that have brought the world to the brink of World War III?
Absolutely not. I mean, The World War III wasn't going to come about. I mean, who were we going to be fighting? China? We brought the Chinese communists to power. All you need to do is go back and read the McCarran Committee report, the Senate report about how the United States State Department actually brought the communists to power by undercutting the nationalist Chinese, and despite the fact that the United States Congress had appropriated hundreds of millions of dollars to be sent in military supplies to the nationalist Chinese. Why, of course, these ships were held up in the harbors here in the United States for a year and a half, and when they finally did arrive in China and they unpacked the rifles, they didn't have any firing pins in the rifles. They were useless. Now, we brought communism to China, and we brought communism to Russia, and they weren't going to go to war with us. But they wanted you to make you think that, oh, my goodness, we couldn't possibly try to win the war. We're just going to go over and fight for 10 years but never try to win the war. I mean, all you had to do was bomb the dikes in North Vietnam, knock out the electric plants in North Vietnam. I mean, suddenly block the railroads that were carrying the supplies from Haiphong, over to where they could be taken down the Ho Chi Minh Trail. The idea that we were going to, precipitate a war. So it was totally ridiculous, but that was the justification that had to be used for the American people as to why we never tried to win the war and why we sent 58,000 American boys over there to fight and bleed and die over there for absolutely nothing. It was the Vietnam War was fought as a diversion, so that we would not be watching what was going on at home. And, of course, anybody who wants to check that out, I suggest the lead article in the January 1967 the issue of Foreign Affairs magazine written by McGeorge Bundy, a member of Skull and Bones, a member of the CFR, and the National Security Advisor to President Johnson, who was instrumental in getting us involved in the quicksand and the quagmire of Vietnam. And he will tell you, we were involved in a social revolution And if we got out of Vietnam, there'd be reaction. There'd be opposition to their plans to bring socialism to America. That's the theme of the article, the end of either or, referring to either guns or butter. Anything else, Herman?
Well, are you suggesting then that the nuclear standoff between Russia and the United States, that for example, the Cuban Missile Crisis, that at any moment the wrong move could have triggered a nuclear exchange? I mean, Russia obviously had and has nuclear weapons. I mean, even one nuclear weapon dropping on one of our cities would definitely cause devastation.
That is exactly what they want you to do. They want you to be fearful of the nuclear weapons. We're all going to be incinerated if we do the wrong thing. Actually, how did Russia get their nuclear weapons? Why, we sent them the message. There's a wonderful book called From Major Jordan's Diary. Major George Racy Jordan was in charge of the Air Force base at Great Falls, Montana, where, of course, during the Second World War, we were shipping equipment to Russia, and he tells how Harry Hopkins, the right-hand man of FDR, sent the plans for the atom bomb to Russia during the war, along with heavy water and deuterium and all the supplies they needed to manufacture the bomb. We gave the Russians the A-bomb. The book, again, from Major Jordan's diary, and most people have never read it. I mean, we have done everything we could to equip the Russians with military weapons, and certainly they've never been as strong as they have. Well, we have tried to convince the American people, oh, my goodness, we've got to be fearful of the Soviet Union. We financed the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union would have collapsed at any time. And, of course, those were the days when Khrushchev was in charge. And, of course, we only have to point out that Khrushchev, the most powerful man in Russia, went off for a weekend down in the Black Sea at a resort there. And it was David Rockefeller who went over to Russia. And when Khrushchev came back after the weekend, he was no longer the premier. Who is powerful enough to replace the dictator of Russia? This is covered in a book called None Dare Call It Conspiracy. None Dare Call It Conspiracy by Gary Allen. Who is it who is powerful enough to replace the most powerful man of the Soviet Union, Khrushchev? Well, David Rockefeller was over there, and when Khrushchev came back from his weekend sortie, why, he was no longer the premier of Russia.
Right.
There are lots of things that the American people don't understand, and that's why we do what we do, because nothing is as it appears to be. And Russia today would be a second-class nation or a third-world nation if it weren't for the massive aid from America. And that's why our little pamphlet, The Communist-Capitalist Alliance, is so important. In fact, the term comes from Solzhenitsyn, who gave a speech in 1975 to the the AFL-CIO. And he talked about how, from the very inception of communism, of the communist revolution in Russia, why the communists had been aided by the capitalists in America. Anything else, Sherman?
Well, that's very true. In fact, I think we built their Kama River truck plant during the Vietnam War, which is the world's largest truck plant. We built it for them in Russia.
Yeah, but at the same time that they were supplying the weapons, they were being used to kill our boys in South Vietnam. And, of course, a lot of the trucks that were going down the Ho Chi Minh Trail were Ford motor trucks built at the Ford plant in Gorky. Most people have forgotten that Henry Ford built that factory for the communists because he was pro-communist. He was also pro-Nazi. He had his factories over there in Nazi Germany, and he was doing everything he could to help the Nazis. Why would he do that? Because Henry Ford was deeply involved in the occult. And that is what everybody has missed. And that is why Henry Ford said nothing wrong with helping communism and helping Nazism, because these are both extensions of what I call the Brotherhood of Darkness. Anything else, Herman?
That's fine. We'll continue listening. Thank you.
Okay, God bless.
Bye-bye.
And our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Give us a call. Love to hear from you. And we'll be talking to Ray here in just a moment, right here at Radio Liberty. Well, hi, Ray. How are you doing tonight?
Pretty good. I wanted to talk a little bit about Nixon's relationship with the Rockefeller family, and Nelson Rockefeller, who I believe...
Gold and silver is tremendously undervalued. Global demand vastly exceeds mined supply by more than 60% annually. There is little in the financial world more certain than a coming explosion in the prices of gold and silver. The U.S. dollar continues to lose value and respect as the world's reserve currency. Our nation faces challenges on many fronts, and a day doesn't pass without another economist bringing forth warnings of impending economic calamity. There has never been a better time than right now to acquire physical gold and silver. Discount Gold and Silver Trading was founded on the principles of truth and honesty. We believe in providing a quality product, quality service, and most importantly, competitive pricing. We provide all forms of precious metals, including American gold, silver, platinum, and rare investment and circulated coins. Silver bars, rounds, and 90% silver bags are on hand for the silver investor. Gold self-directed IRAs are available. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. Toll free, that's 1-800-375-4188.
Most Americans are iodine deficient today because they stopped adding iodine to our milk and to our flour, and only about half of the salt that's consumed in the United States today contains iodine. So Radio Liberty has produced a four tape or a four CD set that discusses the health benefits of iodine. We also offer iodorol. It contains 12.5 milligrams of iodine per tablet. And we also offer potassium iodide tablets that'll protect your thyroid gland in case there's a nuclear attack. So if you'd like to order these products or obtain additional information, why don't you call 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. Or go to our website at RadioLiberty.com. That's RadioLiberty.com. Once again, our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927.
You got headaches? Most headaches are caused by a structural weakness of blood vessels in the head, and the blood vessels are tending to balloon, causing a headache. The structural weakness is due to a deficiency. Correct the deficiency and the body will heal itself. I blended what I believed to be the missing nutrients in the right proportions, and the headaches went away. When they were gone, they stayed gone. I named it Headache Stay Gone. See HeadacheStayGone.com or call 800-327-0727 for more information or to place an order. I'll send you a bottle of Headache Stay Gone. Headache Stay Gone will cure your headaches and prevent them from coming back before you pay the bill. Headache Stay Gone has already cured the worst migraines I have ever heard of. Call 800-327-0727. All orders are shipped the same day. Call 800-327-0727. That's 800-327-0727.
Hi, this is Dr. Tony Thierry. Are you one of the many people who take vitamin supplements? Do you take handfuls of pills each day to increase energy, reduce your pain, or improve your overall health? Now there is a better way to get the vitamins and minerals your body needs in a delicious-tasting whole food liquid supplement, Body Balance. Body Balance contains 121 essential vitamins and minerals and is made from only organic and natural sources. Developed by doctors, Body Balance was originally available only through healthcare professionals. Now this incredible whole food liquid supplement can be delivered directly to your home. Body Balance offers an extremely effective method to feed your body towards wellness, and we're confident you'll love the difference your body feels. To order your Body Balance, call me directly at 1-800-768-9763 and try it risk-free for 45 days. Again, that's 1-800-768-9763 or online at healthyfoundations.net.
The assassination of President Kennedy, and Ray had brought up Jack Ruby, and of course pointed out that Ruby was part of the mafia, but that we have to understand why he walked into the police station there in Dallas and gunned down Lee Harvey Oswald, because he knew he was going to be shot. It would be totally illogical to have done that. Well, if you read the book written by Chuck Giancano, the brother of Sam Giancano, why Chuck Giancano tells you why Ruby did what he did. And, of course, it was because he was ordered to by the mafia.
Yeah.
And he was told that if he did not do what he was told, he would be tortured to death and everybody in his family would be tortured to death. And that's the sort of offer you get that you can't refuse. When the mafia gives you an offer like that, you better go along with it, because they're deadly serious. And they have no respect for human life, and that's why the CIA works so closely with them.
Yes, sir.
And they used, of course, the CIA to carry out their assassinations in this country. They used the special forces to carry out assassinations in other countries. And then the CIA could always say, "Why, we never assassinate anybody." Mm-hmm. And that's true. They get other people to do that, but they can say with completely clear why the CIA doesn't assassinate people. Well, if you read the book, Double Cross, we no longer carry it, but you can get that off the Internet, and we recommend it for you. We think it's a very important book.
Also, the Jim Garrison, DVD and, video.
Right.
That's a very good one, too.
Very well done.
And, the whole thing it amounts to the fact that Oswald was a patsy, and I believe that was triangulated crossfire. I believe that there were two men in the depository, two men in the building adjacent to that, and behind the grassy knoll. So I believe that it was a total of six shooters.
Why do you believe that?
Because of the way that the bullets came, they went through Connolly, right, and they went through the president, and but then
they went through the president, then they went through Connolly. They went through the president first.
But those shots, there was a shot that a fifth shot that hit the apparently, according to the to what I've heard, it was a fifth shot that ricocheted off Dealey Plaza overpass, I think.
I'm sure that
there were other shots fired besides the, it definitely couldn't have been a magic bullet involved. I don't believe that there was one bullet. I believe he was hit in the back first and then hit in the brain.
Now, I think that certainly what we have heard from people who were fairly close to what went on, that there were two shooters from the American Mafia, and then there were two shooters from the Corsican Mafia, and of course then they had spotters, and they had people who were directing the shooters, and of course this was a very elaborate conspiracy. It involved the CIA, it involved J. Edgar Hoover and the FBI, certainly it involved people within the Central Intelligence Agency.
Yeah.
What they did is they simply lied to the American people about this. This was a coup d'etat. They got rid of the American president. And, of course, Richard Nixon was involved, certainly. Lyndon Johnson was involved.
Mm.
All the key players were involved. And this is covered in large part in an interview we did with Madeleine Duncan Brown, which is in our JFK assassination update. And Madeleine Duncan Brown was with Lyndon Johnson's mistress, and she tells about the party that was held the night before, and she didn't actually attend the private session, but Lyndon Johnson was there, and Richard Nixon was there, and J. Edgar Hoover was there, and the people who represented the mafia and, of course, the CIA were there, and they talked about and planned the assassination on the following day. Fascinating insight into history, which the average American is never going to hear, but that is called the JFK assassination update, and we certainly recommend it to you.
Yeah.
Hey, well, hang on there. We'll be back in just a moment, Ray. Again, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. If you have a question, you have a comment, you agree, maybe you disagree, but I'd love to hear from you. So we'll be back here in just a moment. Hang on there, Ray. We'll be right back to you as soon as we get through this break. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here. Again, our number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Ray, did you have another question or comment?
Yeah, I had another comment. I don't know if you know about this, but I'm sure you probably do know, but the Amazon rainforest is being destroyed and the water is being diverted because Coca-Cola builds some massive plants down there and they're using up to all the water. And the water's drying up, and the peasants, they have nowhere to, subsist. It's terrible. And I believe it's part of the New World Order. It's part of their operations, to do things like that. I believe that the rainforest is pretty much been destroyed. It's a terrible thing, because it's a very important, waters.
It's really very interesting that certainly the rainforest is being eroded and destroyed, and one of the reasons for this is because the price of corn has gone up so high. The price of corn has gone up so high because we're using corn to make ethanol, and both here in the United States and down in Brazil, where of course a lot of the rainforest is. Why, of course they make their ethanol out of sugar cane. And, of course, it gets you a much better ethanol with a lot more power. But they don't want to do that here. They want to use corn, and, of course, corn makes a very, very poor and inefficient ethanol that doesn't have the energy in it that the ethanol that comes from sugar cane does. But what's happening down in the rainforest is because the price of corn has almost tripled over the last couple of years, thanks to the fact that the government here is not only encouraging ethanol, but is actually subsidizing it, so that they're actually then cutting down the rainforest so that they can have land to grow more in the way of corn. And the corn's, I've forgotten now, $3 or $4 a bushel. But anyway, the price has really gone up. And, of course, with that, of course, it's gone the price of chicken, because chickens ordinarily eat corn. And the mass-produced chickens are getting more expensive. They use corn for fattening up the cows, so the price of meat is going up. And there's no problem facing America today that a new government program...
And of course, they invent worse. They invent the problem.
Right.
And of course, we're the taxpayers. We're suffering.
And absolutely. And now we see the price of all foodstuffs going up, and especially those tied to the use of corn. And they say, oh, shucks, look at that. Look at those prices go. Hold on just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here. Our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or in the Central Coast of California, 464-8295. And we're talking with Ray, and just talking about he was concerned about the rainforest, and I was simply pointing out that a lot of the rainforest is being cut down so that they can clear land to grow corn, because we've artificially raised the price of corn. And, of course, we subsidize the ethanol to the tune of about 51 cents a gallon. And the government gives, because making ethanol is not cost effective, but we're subsidizing it. And then, of course, we put a tariff on the import of a Brazilian ethanol, which, of course, they can manufacture very, very cheaply in Brazil because they use a sugar cane. And, of course, so we've got another 51 cents tacked on to the price of Brazilian ethanol coming into this country. So there's almost a dollar differential. And of course, ethanol is not a good fuel.
No, it's not.
Okay, anything else you want to...
That's all. Thanks, Dr. Stan.
Okay,
talk to you later.
God bless. Bye. And let's go to Susan, who's calling from Massachusetts. And once again, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And hey, Susan, how are you hearing us? Are you hearing us on the internet?
On the internet, yes.
Good to have you with us. Do you have a question or comment?
This is really different than what we've been talking about. What you've been talking about. Do you mind if I ask you a question about the Vatican?
Sure.
What do you recommend that I read to better understand the Pope's role in the New World Order, the New World Religion? I'm a Catholic, and I knew that there was corruption happening in the Vatican, but I thought it was only at the level of cardinals. And I, from things I've been hearing, that it might be the popes also.
I mean,
and I just wanted to try and figure out what role they're playing.
Basically, all of our religions are infiltrated by satanic forces. I mean, this has been going on for literally for centuries, and it's in the Protestant Church as well. I mean, the Catholic Church started out with the highest ideas and purposes and the great saints of the past, but don't you realize that Satan wants to create a one-world government? And rather than attack Christianity from without, you infiltrate it from within. And so what they did is they gradually began bringing all these other ideas into Christianity that had nothing to do with the Bible, the Word of God. They were dictates of men, and they began to bring in, you know, many of these ideas of the goddess. Well, of course, the goddess then became Mary. Mary represented the goddess, and she was almost on a par with Jesus Christ. That is not biblical. What you need to do, of course, is read the Bible. That has to be a final source of information, not what any man says, not what I say, not what the Pope says.
But what I was kind of in denial until I read that Pope John Paul II had for a political advisor Zbigniew Brzezinski, and
right.
Pope Benedict XVI has Henry Kissinger for his political advisor.
Boy, what a gruesome pair that is.
I know it. I couldn't believe it.
They're both tied into the Rockefeller family. And, of course, the Rockefellers are one of the chief evil people in the world today. In fact, if you there's a great deal of information. You know, that people who researched the Lucius Trust, used to be the Lucifer Publishing House, and the name Rockefeller keeps coming up over and over again. As, of course, does the name Robert McNamara. Robert McNamara, the Secretary of Defense, during the Kennedy years, who sent American boys to fight and bleed and suffer and die in Vietnam, but never to be allowed to win. They were simply blood sacrifices to Robert McNamara's God. And I believe if you study the occult, you'll find Robert McNamara and the Rockefellers deeply involved with the occult, and Henry Kissinger as well. So I share your concern.
Yeah, the other thing that concerns me about the current Pope is now he seems like he's jumping on the bandwagon with the UN and the global warming, and he's supposed to speak at the UN in regards to that in the spring.
Well, the thing is, you cannot put your confidence in men. And that's the difficulty of with so many religions, is that we tend to follow the leader rather than to follow the Word of God. And that has to be the source of our knowledge, the focus of our attention. It's the Word of God, not what men say about it, that's important. And I don't believe that there's any justification for saying we have to follow the leadership of this man, because, after all, he is the descendant of Peter, and because he's a descendant of the disciple Peter, then of course he is God's vicar on this earth. I believe, of course, that what we're doing is following men rather than following God.
Isn't it ironic? I don't know if I should say this, but that the Pope Benedict's birthplace is Bavaria, and that's same birthplace of the Illuminati, right?
Well, but I mean, that's probably just a coincidence. I would not try to make any major tenet of my belief based on that, but it is an interesting thing.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, men are fallible, and even many men who mean very well are fallible, and we will find, you know, certainly within the Protestant Church, some very, very evil and wicked people in key positions, as the as we had the gentleman who was actually the head of the National Association of Evangelical Christians. You remember, he turned out to be a homosexual and a cocaine user. And yet he managed to hoodwink all of these good Christians.
Yeah.
And I will tell you that the whole of the hierarchy of the Protestant Church, directly or indirectly, is infiltrated. There are a lot of good people there who love the Lord, but there are a lot of bad people there who have their own agendas. And the same thing is true within the Jewish religion. And the same thing is certainly true within the Catholic religion.
Well, I am Catholic, and it's just heartbreaking when you realize...
Susan, the important thing is to not lose your faith in our
Lord Jesus Christ.
No. That is what is... My fear is that as people see the corruption in the Catholic Church and the pedophilia in the Catholic Church and the sexual molestation of the Catholic Church and the hundreds of millions of dollars they're paying out to silence people and to pay off the people that have been traumatized by the sexual molestation of the priests, that they will tend then to discredit Christianity. And that's
the last thing. I never will do that.
All right.
My faith.
Your relationship is to our Lord Jesus Christ.
Right.
Not to any man or structure.
Okay. And thank you.
God bless you. Thanks so much,
God bless
Susan.
You. Thank you. Bye.
Okay, fine. And certainly, that was Susan calling from Massachusetts. Our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295. And I know many Catholics who love the Lord and who read the Bible, but of course they were raised as Catholics and they'll probably die as Catholics. However, it's how we apply this, and do we believe in the Bible? Do we believe it's the infallible Word of God? And is it the center of our religious beliefs? And then if you want to be a Catholic and have all the trappings of the Catholic Church, fine, but understand at the very top of all religions are the dark and sinister forces who are intent upon destroying religion and bringing about a new world religion. Christianity is under attack today. You can see it here at Christmas time as they've done everything they could possible to take Christ out of Christmas. And, of course, people don't say, Merry Christmas. I'm sure Christians do, but you're not hearing a lot of Christmas songs on radio. You're not seeing Christmas programs on television. When you go into the stores, why, you don't see nativity scenes or anything that would focus our attention on Jesus Christ. And yet Jesus Christ is the reason for the season. Our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295. If you have a question, if you have a comment, why, we would love to hear from you, because this is Open Line Wednesday and we depend upon your calls to keep the program going. But it's so vitally important, as you look and you see what's happening at Christmas time, that you not be influenced. Because remember, the media is controlled in America. Our major corporations are largely controlled in the United States. And the major corporations that have the department stores that you go into are anti-Christian. They hate Christianity. And people will say, oh, they're all Jewish controlled. That has nothing to do with being Jewish controlled at all. A lot of them aren't Jewish controlled. But there is this hatred, and the people who've amassed so amazing amounts of wealth, many of them have amassed that wealth because they certainly have an agreement with the beings from the other dimension. And there really is another dimension out there. Certainly the Bible tells us to avoid mediums and fortune tellers and diviners and these people who have this supernatural power. Where do they get it? Where does the medium get their power? Well, of course, they are in contact with the other dimension. That's, of course, how they are able to know what the future holds. And some of the fortune tellers and mediums are frauds, but some of them are really very accurate. We have certainly our good friend Joanna Michelson was a medium, and she was actually involved in faith healings, 400 miraculous faith healing. She was being trained to actually to be able to do psychic surgery until she eventually realized that this was all from the other world. This was from the other dimension, that the power was coming to do these miraculous things. And if you haven't read Johanna's wonderful book, The Beautiful Side of Evil, or certainly listen to our 4-tape set on the supernatural, let me recommend it to you, because I think it's so vitally important that people understand that there is another dimension, that there really are people in contact with the beings from the other dimension, and there is supernatural power you can tap into. But let me plead with you, do not do it. Well, let's go to Larry, who's calling from Northern Illinois. Again, our number 1-800-544-8927. Hi, Larry. How are you doing?
Hello, Dr. Stan. Thank you for taking my call.
Okay, fine. Now, you're a historian?
Yeah, actually, I'm a graduate out of Western Illinois University. And I am a first-time caller, but a long-time listener to your show.
Okay, well, it's good to have you with us.
Yeah, the first time I heard your show was years ago, and my father tuned it in on the radio, and I was like, oh, come on. And
you probably thought we were crazy.
Well, it seemed to me that it couldn't be, because if what you said was true, then there's dastardly deeds going on behind the scenes that are completely undermining your and I's best interests. Well, this is the first time I ever called, but I wanted to talk about the history of what some of the things I've heard you talk about.
All right, fine.
Where I'm coming from.
Okay, go ahead.
When I was in, college, I always noticed that it was a cleaned-up version of history. It was always, everything's happy, it's got a smiley face on it.
Right.
And then they said, well, go do a project. Go do archival research for original source material for your papers, for your research projects. And I said, oh, okay. And I noticed it was a completely different story than the cleaned-up version I had been given in class. The original sources, materials I had from archival resources, recordings, manuscripts, original documentation, was just unbelievably different than what I had been told in school. The scandals that were hushed up, the people that were made to seem pure or clean, it was very frustrating to me. So I wanted to call and thank you for pointing some of these things out to me. My study was American history in the 20th century, and it was just a very, very much an opening experience for me. So I want to thank you for that.
I appreciate it. And have you ever read Professor Quigley's wonderful book, Tragedy and Hope, A History of the World in Our Time?
No, I have not. If I
could suggest that this is a great place to really begin to get behind the scenes, because he was really one of the leading historians of the last century, and he had come across this secret society, and that's really what the story is all about, is about this secret society he stumbled onto just by accident, and how that secret society had become the invisible government of the United States. And he was certainly a professor. He had been at Harvard and Princeton and Georgetown University. In fact, Samuel Huntington, a professor at Harvard today, has referred to Quigley as one of the great historians of his time.
Mm-hmm.
And we carry the book. The book was actively suppressed for many years. Somebody bought up the publisher and destroyed the place in the first half of the book, and we even have an interview with Professor Quigley where he tells that story.
Yeah, I have. I've downloaded the about 80 shows now offline over the last couple of months, and each one is like, come on. And then I do the research, I'm like, oh, he's actually right. And it isn't pleasant, audience. There are, again, Dr. Stan, you pointed out, there are evil people behind the scenes that are bent on their own goals and agenda. I've just actually ordered the website, there was a Creature from Jekyll Island.
Very, very good book.
Yeah, now I've heard it twice now, in your show and another show, and I have to read this book. I'm really excited about that. So.
I think you'll really enjoy it. It's written by Ed Griffin, and I've known Ed for 45 years, and he's still going strong.
Oh, good. It's important that this message get out, because when I saw it in class, it was, and if strong strongest suit I saw in class is if you didn't hold up the mantra. You didn't say, toe the line, so to speak, of repeating what the teacher told you. It was detrimental to your grade.
Amen to that, that's for sure.
And I got lower grades than where I should have been in university. And it annoyed me because I have that on my transcript now. But
I'll tell you what, because I entered college, I was 16. And, I will have to admit, in some of my classes, I modified my position. I wasn't very smart at that time. I modified my position to bring it in line with the professor. And that way I got straight A's.
Yeah.
But, of course, it really wasn't a very principled thing to do. But when you're 16 years old and you're competing with all these kids, 19 and 20, many of them back from the military, why? I just did not have the courage of my convictions at that time. Hey, hold on for just a moment. Well, Larry, do you have anything else you wanted to say before we let you go?
No, that's about it. I just wanted to thank you for your message, and I can verify that under the structure that we exist, an educational system in this point is very much slanted towards the toe the line, repeat the mantra, don't step out of line because we know what's right, not you. And actually, my undergraduate paper was on the Vietnam War. And when I showed it to my father became irate to me. He would say, you didn't show respect to the men that were there and what they went through. And I went back and I rewrote the paper, and the original draft, I got an A, and the final paper, I got a C. He said, you changed it completely. And it was very much, I learned what I needed to learn, and I'm still working through that, but it's great. I recommend anybody to do original source researching.
Amen to that. And, of course, another excellent historian is Professor, Dr. Dennis Cuddy. You can depend on his research. It is very, very accurate. Anyway, God bless. Thanks very much for calling, Larry.
Bye-bye.
And let's go to Robert from Aurora, Colorado. Hi, Robert.
Yes, good evening, Dr. Montaigne. Thanks for taking my call. Appreciate that. I guess I just made it in under the wire.
Right, but you just got a quick question there. We're almost out of time.
All right, I'll try to be brief. The government seems to be going after, all of a sudden, the big church guys, Creflo Dollar, Kevin Copeland, on and on and on. I find this a little bit amusing because I'm assuming those people are all 501c3, so they're playing the ball game, although that is unconstitutional if I understand the way I think I understand it. So I guess my question is, why would they go after them if they have always played along with the government's unconstitutional rules?
Because I think they're trying to discredit Christianity, and some of these people, like this fellow Dollar, there's real questions about his theology and how he's getting a lot of money in there, and I think probably as they begin looking behind the scenes, they'll find a lot of these people are stuffing their pockets with money, and they want to discredit Christianity. We got a lot of wonderful ministers out there who are just eking out a living because they want to preach the Word of God. We have some of the people on television who are using Christianity to enrich themselves, and I think that the purpose of these investigations is to discredit Christianity. And so much of what's going on, is leading people to say, gee, that's Christianity. I don't want anything to do with it. That's my opinion anyway.
Mm-hmm. Makes sense. Okay. Thanks for your time.
God bless, and thanks very much for calling. That was Robert calling from Aurora, Colorado, and Christianity is under attack today. We'll be back in just a moment to wrap up tonight's program. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and this is the time when I have to remind our listeners out across America that Radio Liberty is primarily listener-supported, and we're really supported by people who listen to our programs and who are able to help us financially. And if you are able, we do hope that many of you give serious consideration to joining the Radio Liberty family of supporters and making a monthly contribution. Of course, you can join the Tape of the Month Club, get our four best tapes or CDs of the month. You can actually get our monthly newsletter, although we're a little bit behind, but we'll be getting caught up. But certainly we hope that many of you, if you're able to, will support Radio Liberty and help us maintain the almost 60 outlets we have every week. We our Saturday program goes to about 27 or 28 stations, and it's only half an hour, but it's people are hearing the truth. And then our evening state programs go to about 11 stations, including shortwave and internet, and or 12 stations, including shortwave and internet. We're fortunate to have what we have. We'd like to expand it, but right now we want to hang on to what we have. So if you can help us, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. And then, of course, Larry had called in about history. If you haven't read Professor Quigley's book, Tragedy and Hope, A History of the World in Our Time, and his second book, The Anglo-American Establishment, you need to. And, of course, along with that, you need to hear the interview with Professor Quigley, and you need to get the book, Foundations, Their Power and Influence, to find out that the Rockefeller, Carnegie, and Ford foundations have been financing communism since its very inception. So we encourage you to actually go ahead and get these books. They're very, very important. Tragedy and Hope was, Professor Quigley's book was actively suppressed for many years. Somebody came in and bought up the publisher, Macmillan, and destroyed the plates of the first half of the book so it could not be reproduced. And if you find that impossible to believe, why, of course, you need to get the interview with Professor Quigley, where he tells you the story. And I found the interview when I went through Professor Quigley's papers back at Georgetown University, doing the primary research on my own, and was able to purchase that tape from Professor Quigley's widow. And we've put out hundreds, if not thousands, of copies of Professor Quigley's interview. It was done with a Washington Post reporter. But, of course, it gives you tremendous insight into his thought. He was a liberal historian, and he looked upon people like you and I as the petty bourgeois who voted for Barry Goldwater. He, of course, looked down upon us because we're just common people. But even though he was an elitist and identified with the elite, the information he makes available to us in his book and in his interviews is so vitally important. Unfortunately, Professor Quigley missed what it was all about. He had the greatest story of all time, and we're deeply indebted to him for his research, but he missed the spiritual forces that energized the people that he studied, like Cecil Rhodes and Lord Milner and J.P. Morgan and the others who were involved in this effort to create a new world and a new world religion. Well, you need to, of course, to get my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, which then we'll take you the next step beyond Professor Quigley. Our telephone number is 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. Our webpage, of course, is radioliberty.com. We do hope you'll go there. If you need a Christmas gift, we have something called the Freedom Documents. It was put together by Chuck Baldwin, Pastor Chuck Baldwin. It's all the major documents that deal with our freedom, that from the Mayflower Compact to President Washington's farewell address to the Declaration to the Constitution, all of the freedom documents are there, the Gettysburg Address, there are 50 of them. We recommend it, it's available. It's called the Freedom Documents, a wonderful, wonderful gift for anybody who loves America. Our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. And we ask you then to pray for America. We ask you to pray for revival, because this is a spiritual battle. We ask you to pray for our leaders, our ministers, but please pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection until tomorrow night. May the Lord be with you. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming into the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views and the views of our guests. And, well, for this hour, one of my favorite guests, William Grieg, formerly senior editor of the New American Magazine and now doing a lot of writing and radio, and certainly is appearing regularly here at Radio Liberty, keeping abreast of what's going on. And he has a wonderful blog site. You'll want to get his information. Hi, William. How are you doing tonight?
I'm doing great.
Things looking a little bit better up there at the house?
You're referring, of course, to this apocalyptic problem with the plumbing we had over the weekend. Yes, everything is ship-shape and Bristol fashion now, I'm happy to say.
All right, I'm so glad
to hear
that. A couple
of days, but we're all right now. Thanks so much for asking.
All right, fine. Well, what are we going to talk about this evening?
I think we ought to talk a little bit about something that I'm really, quite frankly, terrified by, and that is something we talked about last week. Stephen Breyer, the Associate Justice of the Supreme Court, during oral arguments a week ago regarding this appeal of a law that was passed a year ago, the Military Commissions Act, made a suggestion just blindly in an offhand way to Paul Clement, the Solicitor General of the United States, that the Congress of the United States needs to pass a law providing for the preventive detention of people who are considered dangerous. The course of this conversation has yet to be fully fleshed out in any of the news accounts that I have read so far, but we know enough about what was said to know that it was profoundly unsettling. The court case has to do with the number of people who were confined to Guantanamo Bay, the facility down there which is being used to detain people who are considered to be terrorist suspects, who are captured on battlefields, or simply gathered up in these large-scale canvases for terrorist suspects and brought there for open-ended detention as unlawful enemy combatants. And that, by the way, is a status that is completely spurious. You're either a POW or you're a criminal suspect. There really is no tertium quid. There's no third option here. But a number of these people, working through various activist groups, not all of which, by the way, are left-wing. There are people who are career military men, including JAG officers, Judge Advocate General officers, who have written amicus briefs on behalf of these detained terrorist suspects in Guantanamo Bay. The Rutherford Institute, which is an estimable, socially conservative, trending toward libertarian legal activist group, also filed an amicus brief on behalf of the detainees. But they are claiming that they have standing under the Constitution, under the principle of habeas corpus, to appeal their open-ended detention. And one group of these people are Algerian nationals who were arrested in Bosnia, in the former Yugoslavia, and who were put on trial in 2001, or late 2001, early 2002, on terrorism charges. They were acquitted in early 2002 by a Bosnian court, which was created, staffed by people who were trained by the United States, funded by the United States, and yet they were immediately taken into military custody, shipped to Guantanamo Bay, and in spite of the fact they were acquitted of terrorism charges, they've been held for 6 years without a trial, without a subsequent trial.
And I think it's very interesting that the military officer who was in charge of the trials at Guantanamo has recently resigned his military commission.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
He was a judge advocate general, you know, on the Sydney JAG officer. And he resigned because he said, I realized we could not get fair trials. Now, you know, when the man, the officer, the military officer, gives up his whole career, professional military, because he says you can't get a fair trial, why, of course, well, we're talking about terrorists, but could we be talking about you and I next? We'll be right back.
Yeah, that's exactly right. You've touched upon a principle that I wish people would understand, which is that you give the devil the benefit of the law, the protection of the law, for your own safety's sake. That's the principle which was articulated in that wonderful film, A Man for All Seasons, with Paul Scofield playing St. Henry, or St. Thomas More. And the principle obtains here when you're talking about people who, in this instance, were acquitted of terrorism charges. That's a part of the story that I think the heroic officer who just resigned probably would be in a position to address, the fact that these Algerian nationals, who may or may not be nice guys, were acquitted of terrorism charges in a fair trial conducted by a court that was created with U.S. help, funded by U.S. taxpayer dollars, and which was staffed by people who were trained by the American Bar Association and other elements of the U.S. judicial system. In other words, it was more or less the paradigm of what we would consider to be a reasonably fair and clean trial. And they were let go, and the United States government exercised some kind of pressure on the Bosnian Muslim government, took these people into custody, sent them to Gitmo, where they'd been in prison for 6 years, despite the fact they were acquitted of terrorism charges. And there are two groups of defendants who are involved in this appeal, which, and their claim is that they have a right to appeal their detention through the principle of habeas corpus, the ancient common law right, the common law guarantee that you cannot be summarily imprisoned without some recourse, some legal recourse, either to a judge or to a trial, a jury trial or some other court hearing. What the Bush administration is saying is that the Military Commissions Act foreclosed that possibility by denying habeas corpus protections to anybody who is considered a terrorism suspect, and a foreign national in particular. And as we have explained on a couple of occasions in different conversations, the habeas corpus guarantee is not contingent on the identity of the person who is invoking that right. It obtains everywhere the United States government claims jurisdiction. It's a restriction on what the government can do. It has nothing to do with the status or the nationality of the person invoking that right. That's something that Thomas Jefferson made emphatically clear, and he was of a piece with most of the founding fathers on that subject. In a couple of very dramatic statements, one made in 1798 when the right of habeas corpus, the guarantee of habeas corpus, was under assault because of the Alien and Sedition Acts, which were passed during the administration of John Adams. And then in his first inaugural address as president in 1801, Thomas Jefferson emphasized the fact that habeas corpus is the grand foundation of the whole system of liberty protected by law. And it doesn't matter whether you're talking about a citizen or non-citizen, anywhere our government claims the power to inflict punitive sanctions on people, those are
hold
the end of their sanctions.
Hold that thought right there, William. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is William Greig, and he's simply pointing out that according to Jefferson and founding fathers, the right of habeas corpus did not simply apply to American citizens. It applied to anyone who was under the jurisdiction of our government. And they could be foreigners, but that was all right. They did not have to be citizens, but it was, they had the right to habeas corpus, because habeas corpus is a means of limiting the government's ability to throw people into prison, to throw them into dungeons, where they will never have the opportunity to present their proof of their innocence. And this, if they can do this to non-citizens, can they do it to citizens? They did it to Padilla. And was there any outcry? Where was the outcry from, you know, from the average American citizen over Padilla, who was a naturalized citizen, who was actually sent to prison for 3 years without a right for habeas corpus or to have a court hearing? And then, of course, he was convicted in a trumped-up trial where they used emotion rather than facts to convict him. In fact, the truth of the matter is, Padilla was offered, you know, to go scot-free if he'd just become an informant for the American government. He refused to do that, and, well, we know what happens when you refuse to go along with the government. Being an informant, Randy Weaver, they killed his wife and son. And with Padilla, they're sending him to prison for the rest of his life. And what was his crime? They never proved it.
Well, the case of Padilla, I think, is of signal importance here because, as you point out, he's a U.S. citizen who is treated to the full suite of abuses in terms of what are called enhanced interrogation techniques. By the way, that is a term of art for torture, which was used by the Nazi war criminals at Nuremberg to justify their use of exactly the same techniques. It's amazing that in its search for cloying euphemisms, the Bush regime has seized upon exactly the same phrase in English translation that was used by the National Socialists in Germany to conduct pretty much the same variety of torture techniques for use against people who were suspected of counter-revolutionary or terrorist or partisan activities. Interestingly enough, the Germans didn't use waterboarding, but the Imperial Japanese did, and there were Imperial Japanese who were sent to the firing squad because they had used waterboarding in the Philippines and elsewhere as a method of extracting intelligence. Now we see waterboarding isn't considered... you can't even use the term torture in the so-called liberal media to describe waterboarding, in spite of the fact that there were people, both Imperial Japanese war criminals, and also, this is an interesting part of the whole discussion, also U.S. law enforcement officials in the early decades of the 20th century who were sent to prison for torturing suspects using waterboarding in a couple of states. For instance, there were cases in Mississippi where really corrupt local sheriffs would use waterboarding, a very crude version of that very refined torture, in order to punish people who were considered holdouts in various criminal investigations. These people were sent to prison. Teddy Roosevelt, by the way, in the first term of his presidency, made a point of instructing military prosecutors to find out the identity of American servicemen who were waterboarding suspected insurgents and civilian partisan fighters in the occupied Philippines during the 1899-1902 war against the Philippine insurrection. That's where the Philippines first had their taste of this torture called waterboarding. Although I don't know for sure whether it might have been practiced earlier, because it goes all the way back to the Spanish Inquisition. But for the purpose of modern history, you could say that the first place where it was used for counterinsurgency purposes was under the U.S. occupation in the early years of the century. And Teddy Roosevelt made a point of prosecuting military personnel under the Uniform Code of Military Justice for using waterboarding, or as it was called back then, the water cure. And now we see the same technique being used by the CIA and being used by military interrogators against people like Jose Padilla, who was probably subject to waterboarding, but he was certainly subject to psychological torture, sensory deprivation. There have been pictures of him that I posted on my website where he is wearing sensory deprivation goggles and a hood, and his interrogators have their faces masked. It's pretty clear on the basis of psychological examinations of Padilla that his mind was effectively destroyed through over 2.5 or 3 years of continual concentrated abuse of this sort. And this was all permissible because he was designated by the president an unlawful enemy combatant, in spite of the fact that he was and still is a U.S. citizen. He didn't have the right to habeas corpus, supposedly. He couldn't challenge his detention because of that status. So the precedent was already laid here for the denial of habeas corpus rights and that guarantee to U.S. citizens. And the Military Commissions Act has now codified that for use not only against non-citizen nationals who are detained as terrorist suspects or unlawful combatants, but also for anybody of any nationality, including U.S. citizens, who find themselves thus designated. The thing that I find really horrifying about the discussion last week was Stephen Breyer's offhand suggestion that in order to prevent further challenges to, perhaps even the overturning of, the MCA, Congress needs to come out with an additional law that would provide formally for the preventive detention of people who are called dangerous. Now, that is a perfectly horrifying suggestion for a number of reasons, the first of which is that it is entirely foreign to the tradition of American law and to the better elements of Anglo-Saxon common law to bring about the summary imprisonment of people who have not violated a law. You simply cannot do that. I mean, that's an elaboration of the habeas corpus idea, but you cannot simply say that somebody is innately dangerous and imprison that person because of who you believe he is. I mean, the Constitution forbids the passage of bills of attainder. A bill of attainder is essentially that kind of a law. There's also a line in there referring to the fact that you cannot pass a law that is based on the assumption that somebody's ancestry works corruption of blood. In other words, you can't say that a person is somehow incriminated in the crimes of his ancestors or his relatives by virtue of being related to them. That's what that somewhat obscure passage of the Constitution refers to, I believe. So that reflects this common law understanding that you cannot punish somebody for what he is or what you suspect he is doing or what you suspect he is like. You have to have some discrete evidence that he has violated a specific law or that he was conspiring to do the same. He was making some kind of positive, documentable acts in the furtherance of a conspiracy to violate a law. You can't simply say someone is dangerous and imprison him for that reason. Here's Stephen Breyer, on the other hand, last week, a week ago, talking to Paul Clement, who was a very easy audience for this suggestion, saying Congress needs to pass this law. And this law would be the product of a totalitarian vision of what the state can do. Back in September of 1793, the revolutionary French government passed a decree called the Law of Suspects, which said that six classes of people should be considered enemies of the state who are subject to summary imprisonment or extermination on the whim of the government. By this time, of course, the revolutionary government had inaugurated a war against most of the countries in Europe, and it had also gotten involved in the civil war against the traditional Catholics of a region of that country called Livonia, or the Vendée. The traditional Catholics had risen up against the revolutionary government because the government had passed a law called the Levy en Masse, which was a general conscription. They were going to go in and start scooping up their children of these traditional Catholics who were being raised in traditional homes and schooled in either parochial schools, what we now call parochial schools, or homeschooled. And the anti-clerical government, the anti-Catholic government of the revolutionary regime, was going to take these kids and force them to go fight other Catholics in countries like Austria in order to advance the revolution. And so the Vendeans said, we're not down with that. We are not going to cooperate. And so a rebellion broke out, and that rebellion ended up becoming a full-scale war where the government of France, using laws like this Law of Suspects, ended up exterminating between 200,000 and 350,000 people. And this is all done because they had created this mechanism based on this law that some people are innately dangerous, and as dangerous people are subject to imprisonment or annihilation by the government at its convenience. Now, the Bolshevik government of Soviet Russia, when it came to power in the 1917-1918 revolution, began, of course, in what we call the October Revolution. It was consolidated with the creation of the Cheka in 1917-1918-1919. In 1922, they created a committee on what were called exiles. Now, an exile was somebody who was uprooted from his home in whatever part of Russia he lived and sent to the Gulag Archipelago. And the foundation for the Gulag, the legal foundation for the Gulag, was something very similar to this Law of Suspects that was passed in revolutionary Jacobin France. It was Article 58 of the Basic Penal Code of the Soviet Union. Article 58 said that there were people who were considered socially dangerous persons who did not have any standing before the law in terms of protections or immunities or due process. And as socially dangerous persons, they could be gathered up by the secret police, at the time it was called the Cheka, and treated as the state saw fit. That could involve prevented detention, it could involve exile to the Gulag, it could involve being taken to the basement of the Lyubanka headquarters of the KGB and shot. But the point is, Article 58 was the descendant of this Law of Suspects that was passed by the revolutionary French regime. And I think that these are both the ancestors of the law that Stephen Breyer is talking about, where you would have the Congress say that certain people are to be considered dangerous, innately dangerous, and subject to preventive detention. And he didn't specify what form that preventive detention would take, whether it would be something as mild as a delay at an airport or something as severe as being sent to Gitmo.
Well, I think that there is an elite group of women who really feel, of course, that they should be in charge, that they should use the power of the state, you know, to carry out their ideas. And certainly, as I remember, Stephen Breyer is a Rhodes Scholar in CFR. Yes. And, of course, he is one of these elite people who believes in the New World Order. And certainly, people like you and I who oppose what's going on, we're troublemakers. We're mm-hmm. potential terrorists. We might oppose what the government is doing. And I really think, of course, that until we understand there are people who look at the world differently than you and I, there really are evil people out there. We can't understand what's going on. Right ahead.
Stephen Breyer is part of that elite group. He's somebody who very definitely looks upon the world in sort of a pyramidal fashion, where there's a tiny group of enlightened souls like himself who have the duty and the destiny of presiding over lesser folks like you and me. And to that end, of course, they need to make intelligent, cunning use of the power of the state to reform what they consider to be defects in the way that we live. And if our defects are extraordinary, then we're simply to be cold. That more or less is the philosophy we're talking about. I think that one of the best analyses of that mindset was offered by Paul Craig Roberts in a book he co-authored a few years ago, almost a decade ago, called, I think it's called The Tyranny of Good Intentions, if I remember correctly. A splendid book, but perfectly infuriating, and it really changed the way I looked at the legal system, particularly at prosecutors and judges. And The Tyranny of Good Intentions, according to Paul Craig Roberts, is best illustrated by the way that our legal system, which produced people like Stephen Breyer, and produced people like the Federalist Society veterans on the conservative side who want to exalt the power of the executive above pretty much any form of moral accountability, they believe that the best way to bring about a safe and secure society is to obviate the need for due process, which means that you have to find ways of preventing people from actually taking cases to trial. And so they use these often exotic methods of stacking up charges against a hapless defendant so as to get him to sign the plea bargain. In many cases, you're dealing with somebody who has not committed a crime against persons or property. He may have committed some kind of a technical violation of a regulatory act or a bureaucratic code. But by stacking up the charges against somebody to where he's facing the possibility of long, hard time in prison unless he yields to the government, they're able to extract from that person a plea bargain agreement that is often a form of self-destructive perjury, because generally speaking, when somebody signs a plea bargain agreement, it's not a real criminal who's getting off lightly. That's the way that it's always portrayed, for instance, in most of the conservative media and many television shows, that a plea bargain benefits the hardened criminal. Usually a plea bargain is something which is to the detriment of somebody who's just an innocent citizen who's not harmed anybody. And so you end up with a situation that is pretty much interchangeable with what happened in the 1930s under the Soviet system, where they were always interested in getting some kind of a confession. There was a memorable exchange between Joseph Stalin and I believe it was Vyshinsky, the chief prosecutor of the show trials of the late 1930s. There was an old Bolshevik activist by the name of Kautsky who was holding out. He simply wouldn't confess to being some kind of a counter-revolutionary activist. I can't remember what the specific charge against him was. Of course, it was spurious. The real problem was that he represented a potential rival power center to Stalin, and so Stalin was railroading him to an execution in the basement of the Yabanka. But Kautsky was holding out, and so Stalin began to browbeat the prosecutor, saying, how much does the state weigh? How much does it weigh? With the territory, all of the equipment, the Red Army, all of the agricultural assets that we have, all the plants, the factories, how much do you think it weighs? If we were able to put it all on one scale, how much do you think it would weigh? And Vyshinsky said, if I remember correctly, there's no way of telling. It would be an astronomical, incomprehensible
thing. Hold that thought right there. We'll be back in just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and William Gregg is telling a story that goes back to the Soviet Union, and you sort of pick the basic story up there. Stalin is talking to the prosecutor who's going after one of the men who may be a rival to Stalin, and who's probably going to end up being killed. But Stalin keeps asking the prosecutor, how much would all of the military, all of the things that the Soviet Union possessed, how much would they weigh if we put them in one area and put them on a scale? So pick up the story.
Yeah. The idea was that there would be this overwhelming mass here. How much would this weigh if we were able somehow to gather up all the assets of the state, put it on one gigantic scale, and weigh it? And, of course, by this time, Vyshinsky's getting a little bit flustered. He says, well, Comrade Stalin, I've got no way. There's just no way of knowing, but certainly it would be an incomprehensible figure. And Stalin was getting a little theatrically angry, and he said, well, against that weight, the mass weight of the state, can the will of one man hold out? And Vyshinsky said, no, Comrade Stalin, it's impossible. And so Stalin said, well, go back and give me confession then. You know, make this clear to Kautsky. You simply do not have the means, the willpower, to withstand the aggregate weight of the state. And that's more or less the same philosophy, or philosophy is a badly applied word here, that's more or less the same conceit that you get with many prosecutors today in the United States who are dealing with people who have not committed crimes against persons and property. I want to emphasize and underscore that fact. We're not talking here about people who commit acts of robbery or commit acts of physical mayhem. We're not talking about degenerate, horrible, disgusting people who sexually exploit the innocent. We're talking about people who, for want of a better way of putting it, might have run afoul of OSHA or might have run afoul of the EPA, people who made an error in computing their income tax, people who have found themselves on the receiving end of some kind of counter-narcotics investigation where they ended up in business with the wrong people and innocently of any intention to do any harm to anybody have ended up being caught in this immense dragnet. You know, in other words, people who may have made a mistake or through an accident or circumstance have run up afoul of the law, generally what will happen is a prosecutor will find some way of extracting the maximum possible sentence from a number of different ways of charging the same crime multiple times in order to railroad that person into a plea bargain. And that's more or less the same logic as the Stalinist confessions we saw in the 1930s. The past master of this thing is none other than Rudolph Giuliani. He is one of the most vicious human beings who's ever drawn breath. When he was a prosecutor back in the 1980s and 1990s, and this is something he's been caught on tape bragging about in lectures that he's given to law school students, he invented crimes. A lot of people remember how he would send federal marshals to the floor of the stock exchange and drag people out in handcuffs, needlessly doing so for technical violations of obscure SEC regulations that are subject to, you know, various interpretations. There's no need to have these people frog marched out of the stock exchange, but he'd do it in order to impress upon people the weight of the state and his own might in commanding some element of the weight of the state to get them to break, to get them to yield to his imperious will. And the same kind of thing happened when he was dealing with Milken, the junk bond dealer, who was actually a pretty decent guy, didn't ever commit any crime of fraud or misrepresentation. It got to the point where Rudolph Giuliani was trying to implicate Mr. Milken's 90-year-old father as a co-conspirator by virtue of the fact, I guess, that some of Milken's mail ended up in his father's mailbox. But that's the kind of a person Rudolph Giuliani was. And he bragged, you know, cackling with self-approval over his own exquisite cleverness, talking about how he would invent crimes, how he would torture statutes into providing some kind of a colorful pretext in order to build this huge case with multiple charges against these people, felony counts where they would serve 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 years in prison in order to get a plea bargain from them to make sure that they had some way of getting them to prison. That's the mentality that he represents, that Giuliani represents. And the same thing with the persecution of Martha Stewart. I mean, she was sent to prison not because of insider trading. She wasn't accused of insider trading. She was accused of misleading a federal investigator regarding a perfectly legal transaction. And it's really interesting, and this is something Paul Craig Roberts pointed out in his book, The Tyranny of Good Intentions, there is no reciprocal obligation on the part of a federal investigator to tell the truth to a citizen. You know, if you're accused of misleading a federal investigator, it's a felony, but the feds have the sovereign right to mislead you as they see fit.
Well, it's really an incredible situation, and really, of course, what we're seeing is these ideas of justice, these ideas of right and wrong, these ideas of honesty and integrity have disappeared from so much of our legal system. And what a great tragedy it is, because at one time, I think we had a pretty good legal system. We had men who believed in God and feared God, but of course, we no longer have men who fear God in government. We'll be back in just a moment here at Radio Liberty with our special guest, Mr. William Grigg. Well, Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest, William Grigg. Go right ahead, William.
I've been talking a little bit about some of the ways in which taking different vectors and starting at a different point, we seem to have arrived at, we and the Soviets, the post-Soviet Russians, seem to have arrived at a similar state of affairs here. I mean, they started off with a system that was entirely feudal, and that it evolved or devolved really into outright totalitarianism under Lenin and his epigenes. We started out with the singular heritage of liberty under law, the concept that man was created in the image of God, given rights by our Creator, that government is lent certain powers that are strictly intended to be used in the defense of the God-given rights of the individual. We started out with that concept and heritage, which was the elaboration of that exalted idea. And through decades and centuries now of plotting, scheming, conniving leaders, people who are disfigured by their all-encompassing appetite for power, we've ended up in a situation where really the system that governs us right now, although it isn't as luridly violent or as overtly, transparently oppressive as the Soviet government of Russia during the 74 years of the formal existence of the Soviet Union, in terms of the principles it acts on and the claims it makes, it's really not all that different. And when Stephen Breyer talks about the idea of Congress enacting a law that would allow the preventive detention of dangerous people, he's speaking the language of Soviet totalitarianism. He's not speaking the language of American constitutionalism. He is a stranger in the House of Constitutionalism. As you pointed out, he's somebody who's got a background as a Rhodes Scholar. I believe he's with the Council on Foreign Relations. He's somebody who's talked about the idea of citing. He has cited in some of his opinions the rulings of foreign courts, such as the various European Union and European Commission judicial bodies. And he and a number of other people on the Supreme Court right now have made an annual pilgrimage over to Europe to commune with European judges for the precise purpose of harmonizing their decisions with those handed down by the European community. The European community, whether you call it the European Union or the Eurozone, whether you talk about the ruling European Commission, that is an entity that Mikhail Gorbachev, who knows something about this subject, has referred to as the new European Soviet. I mean, it's, once again, a different model of the same basic design.
And yet, of course, Stephen Breyer has sworn to uphold our Constitution.
Exactly.
Of course, he doesn't believe in the oath that he took. There is no way he would want, of course, to correlate our laws with European laws because they have nothing to do with the Constitution. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is William Grigg. And before we go on, William, I would like you, of course, to go ahead and get your blog site out so
sure.
People would know how they can get the information that you're making available.
The easiest way to get it would be to go to the homepage of the Welch Foundation, which is called The Right Source. And the URL for that is www.rightsourceonline.com. Once again, that's one word, www.rightsourceonline.com. The name of the page is The Right Source, but the URL is just rightsourceonline.com. And if you go to that page, you look at the top left-hand corner, just a little bit down from the top, you'll find my photograph. I'm a large brown guy. I'm sitting there smiling for no apparent reason. If you look in the box, there are two hyperlinks. The one furthest to the right will take you to my daily blog, which is called Pro Libertate. Pro Libertate is a Latin phrase. It means for freedom. And the entire purpose of my daily blog, which is updated between 4 and 6 times a week, I try to make it daily, but there are other contingencies I simply have to address sometimes, such as when I have apocalyptic problems with the household plumbing here. But I try to update it between 4 and 6 times a week as opportunity presents itself. And everything I write is devoted to my all-encompassing obsession with human freedom. Pro Libertate is a project of the Right Source Media Enterprises, for which I serve as editor-at-large. Next Monday, my new book will be available. The new book is entitled Liberty in Eclipse, The War on Terror and the Rise of the Homeland Security State. It will be available through the Right Source website, through the Welch Foundation. I will have shipping and ordering information available through my blog. I intend to make a quantity of it available to you, Dr. Stan. And I want to emphasize something about the title. I'm a somewhat hackneyed and war-weary optimist. An eclipse is a temporary state of affairs. It's a transitory state. Something is eclipsed by a celestial body, and the eclipse will end. It is my sincere hope that at some point, somehow, we'll be able to pull our society out of this flat spin toward absolute despotism that we're in right now. It may be a forlorn hope, but I intend to keep fighting for that as long as I can, as long as God gives me breath, because I've got five small children who are the most amazing blessing that anybody could ever have. I intend to do what I can to ensure that they enjoy some semblance of what I had as a youngster, living in a free and prosperous country where the vistas are wide open for them to progress and develop their God-given talents. And I'm sure that that's true of most of the people that are listening to this program. They have loved ones, whether they're children or grandchildren, to whom they want to bequeath a country that is free and prosperous and at peace. And so I earnestly believe that it's possible to do so. It'll, of course, take a lot of hard work. We're in for a lot of trouble, not only with respect to the legal developments that we talk about, but with respect to what's going on in the economy. I mean, there's no way around a huge dislocation in our economy. And that is going to have social consequences. There's going to be a lot of social turbulence. There's going to be a lot of upheaval that will engender authoritarian reactions that have been well prepared, and the instrumentality is well developed to bring about some real ugly crackdowns in the event that there are social turbulence and dislocations to deal with. But I honestly believe that there is something resilient in the American character that has to do with our Christian heritage, with the fact that we understand the provenance of our rights, the purpose of our existence, that will withstand this. I hope so. I earnestly pray that that will be the case. It's going to take some generous acts of divine intervention if we're going to avoid the worst. But I'm discussing in this book, Liberty and Eclipse, the worst contingencies that confront us, while admonishing people to do what they can to bring about the best, which is some restoration of what we have been given and what we have shamefully squandered, which is this precious, perishable gift of liberty under law. But when I say liberty under law, I'm referring to a law that governs what government can do primarily. You know, God gave us basically two great commandments, and a life of freedom is lived according to those two great commandments. You know, love and fear God, and love your neighbor as yourself. And a government properly constituted, according to the Western tradition, is one that makes it possible for people to obey God's law. That's all I want, that's all I ask for, and that's the least that I will settle for, quite frankly.
Well, of course, all we can do is do our best. I think you've been called, as I feel I've been called, to be on the front lines of this battle, to try to share what we've learned with others and hope that perhaps God can utilize what we are doing to try to preserve this country. Whether we're going to win or not, well, that simply remains to be seen.
Yeah.
Well, we are not required to win. We're required to do our best. And for everybody out there in the listening audience, I hope that you will join William and I and that small cadre of people out there that are using the alternative medium to try to educate the American people. And we can only give you in the listening audience information. You've got to pick up the information and run with it and get it to others. And it doesn't matter whether they want to hear or not. Your job is to tell them whether they believe it or not is really up to our Lord. And when I look upon it that way, of course, I don't get discouraged. Otherwise, if I thought it was up to me, I'd have given up a long time ago.
Well, one of the really impressive things about what we're learning right now, because of the age in which we live, where we're dealing with information technologies where flash mobs can convene very quickly and ideas can pullulate into mini revolutions or large revolutions. What we're learning is that we're really not as eccentric, you and I, as we might have thought, say, 5 or 10 years ago, that there literally are tens of millions of people who retain the impress of our founding principles in their souls. And because of our sullen resistance to innovation, to paraphrase the sainted Edmund Burke, we just don't really think in sufficiently creative terms to justify tyranny. I mean, that's one of the things that people like Stephen Breyer represent to me, is this perverted, self-satisfied, egregiously self-satisfied pseudo cleverness, where they believe that in order to establish themselves as people with whom to be reckoned, they really have to find exotic and carefully wrought, cunningly wrought rationales for tyranny, as opposed to finding new and creative ways to defend freedom. I mean, freedom, I think, bores these people. I honestly think that if you find yourself ensconced in the upper echelons of this power elite, you find freedom to be boring. As a matter of fact, I've read some commentators of a supposedly conservative stripe and complain about that. You know, what fun would it be if the United States government were reduced to its constitutional size and we stopped interfering in the affairs of other countries? You know, what fun would that be if we were simply to pull our troops out of Europe and Asia and stop embarking on these vast exertions of national will in places like the Middle East? You know, the people of that sort talk about national greatness conservatism, how supposedly the mission of our government is to enlist, or better stated, to conscript the participation of the public at large in these grand heroic undertakings that are so fraught with romance and drama. The thing is, most of what is done by way of making life better for people has nothing to do with government. It has nothing to do with coercion. It has to do with what happens in the fertile minds of free people when they're allowed to pursue the perfection of their God-given talents without the imposition of government or the intrusion of busybodies. But that sort of thing bores people who simply, for whatever reason, have this unhealthy, prurient interest in regulating the lives of other people. I simply don't understand what drives people to want to do that, because for whatever reason, I was born without that particular cluster of improper appetites. There was a pop song that came out about 12 or 13 years ago by a band called Tears for Fears, entitled Everybody Wants to Rule the World. And I heard that song and I thought it was a brilliant piece of work, a brilliant piece of pop culture, because it did talk about this appetite that a lot of people have to regiment others. But I said when it came out, I was in college when that song came out, and I said, well, that's an interesting song, but you know what? It's untrue, because I have no desire at all to rule the world. I just want to be left alone by the people who do want to rule the world. I had occasion to think about that song back in 2000 when I went to the United Nations headquarters to cover the Millennium Summit, Millennium Conference, actually. The summit was later on that year, for the New American Magazine. I was in the General Assembly when they were having a meeting of these UN-accredited non-governmental organizations, or NGOs, and the then Secretary General of the UN, Kofi Annan, was somewhat laggard in showing up. And so there was a 20 or 25 minute long wait while they were waiting for Kofi Annan. And people would troop down to the rostrum and then go behind the lectern in order to do a photo opportunity. It was something everybody thought was pretty cool. Hey, I get a chance to speak from the same lectern where the President of the United States or the President of the Russian Federation would harangue the delegates at the opening of the General Assembly every October. And without fail, every one of these people, when they'd go to the lectern, would assume what I call the classic pose of Mussolini on the balcony. You know, thrusting your jaw forward, holding up your fist dramatically as if you were issuing edicts to a naughty world that must bend to your will. I don't know what it is about that particular setting that brings that instinct out in people, but the fact is, you and I, and most of the people who are my close friends, certainly almost everybody in my family, we're people who have no interest in commanding or imposing our will upon other people. And there are tens of millions of people, most of them are gravitating toward the Ron Paul campaign, not necessarily because of the man, but because of the message, who share that same perspective. Just leave us alone. Let us live our lives, develop our talents. Let us tend to our own gardens. Let us tend to our own vine and fig tree. Let us raise our children, and we will respect reciprocally your right to do the same. And this is a message which is resonating, thanks to the miracle of modern technology, in some of the unlikeliest places. Good grief, just a few days ago, there were college students in Tehran who were holding up a sign that said, "Live free or die." And these were people who had been watching Ron Paul videos on YouTube in Tehran.
You know, videos is amazing. What nobody ever talks about is why our Constitution was written as it was and why it was recognized throughout the world as a unique document. Because it was the first time in all history where the power of the state was to be limited by the change of the Constitution so people could be free and be allowed to do what they wanted to succeed, to fail. But the one thing was the government was not to have anything to do with the individual. This was a unique idea. It had never been tried before. And, of course, as John Adams has said, I mean, our system of government was made for a moral and religious people. It would not work for any other. This idea of limiting the power of government was so unique. It had never been tried before, but it was tried here. It worked wonderfully for a time. But, of course, that message has been forgotten because it is no longer talked about by our politicians. It is not taught in our schools. It is not taught in our churches.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, but this wonderful concept of individual freedom under God is still the foundation of our nation, and we need to reclaim it.
We do. And there are people in the world who are studying our heritage and perhaps know a little bit more about it than we do at this point. And they're willing to reclaim our heritage if we don't. And that's the really interesting thing about American constitutionalism, about this philosophy that's been called Americanism, is that it is exportable, but it's not exportable at the point of bayonets and missiles. This is something that will be propagated through mimicry. I mean, there's no reason at all why people can't adapt to their own culture's specific circumstances, the insights of the Declaration of Independence, the Federalist Papers, and the Constitution. There's no reason at all why this isn't something that couldn't take root and grow where the soil is hospitable. I had a conversation about 8 years ago with a fellow by the name of Anatoly Levenchuk, who runs an outfit called the Moscow Libertarian. That's an online Wikipedia-style archive in the Russian language of the papers of American constitutionalism. Not only the ones I mentioned, the Declaration, the Constitution, the Federalist Papers, but also the Articles of Confederation, the Mayflower Compact, the transcribed debates of the various state ratifying conventions, things of the sort, the letters of men like John Adams and George Washington, and also the writings of Ludwig von Mises and Friedrich Hayek and Murray Rothbard and some other titans of the modern classical liberal tradition, Hayek, Knox, people of that sort. And I was talking with him in 1998 or 1999 about the sort of things that were going on in Russia at the time, which are very akin to what's going on now in the United States with internet surveillance and wholesale eavesdropping on telephone conversations and things of that sort. And Mr. Levenchuk is about my age. At the time, he was in his late 30s. And he was of the opinion that there were tens of millions of people in Russia who understood the principles of Americanism and couldn't wait to give them a try if their government would ever permit them to do so. You can see the same thing happening in places like the Czech Republic and Slovakia. You know, Czechoslovakia peacefully fissioned about 10 or 15 years ago. They had a peaceful secession from each other because they decided they'd be better off as two separate countries. And both of them, in many respects, are freer than we are now, not because they're paragons of freedom, but because we've become so socialist. Same thing with Estonia. Estonia is a country that's full of young, bright, talented, creative people. I've met some of them, corresponded with others. I had a long plane flight from Denmark sitting next to an Estonian businessman my age about 10 or 15 years ago. They're intensely anti-communist for good reason. They were dominated by the Soviet Union for decades. And these people do understand the logic of the free market and the logic of free people, free minds, and institutions that are not dominated by the government. So there are places where these ideas are sort of taking root and starting to cross-pollinate with each other. And if you can have people in Tehran understanding the logic of our Constitution, there's hope for that country. The thing that I find very encouraging here is that it's somehow beginning to propagate itself without the active support of any government. Of course, our own government does not want to propagate these ideas abroad because those ideas are subversive of the establishment we have here, which was created in contradiction to our constitutional heritage. But it's encouraging, nonetheless, that these things are taking root abroad at a time when they're under assault here in the United States because these ideas are being kept alive And what I'm finding as I talk with people who are starting to rub their eyes and blink and come out of a years-long stupor over the supposedly all-encompassing threat of what's dishonestly called Islamo fascism, is that they're starting to remember these ideas here as well. That's probably the most overdue and most encouraging of the revolutions that are going on.
In fact, as Jay Leno said when Iraq was working on the Constitution, well, you know, why don't we just go ahead and send them ours because we don't use it much anymore. And, you know, that is so true. We don't use our Constitution, and that is why we're losing our freedom. And that is why America has changed. What we need to do is get back to that Constitution, which I personally believe was the greatest document ever written by men. It's imperfect because men are imperfect, but the idea is inherent there of limiting the power of the government so men could be free. That is an eternal idea, and of course, it cannot be improved upon. Well, William, we've got 3 minutes to wrap up the program.
You're right. It can't be improved on. The Constitution really cannot be improved on, and the amendments which have been affixed to the Constitution, for the most part, have derogated from this idea of the government as a servant that must be kept in a very constrained and subordinate role. I want government to be small enough that we can starve it to death very easily. I want government to be a mendicant, always begging us for what it needs to carry out its limited functions. Grover Norquist once said that he wants to keep government to a size that's sufficiently small that they can be drowned in a bathtub. Unfortunately, he's a hypocrite here because he's somebody who's sort of battened on the Republican establishment as it's better the growth of government. I wish he would be faithful to what he said about the size and weakness of government that he prefers. The thing is, as you said, the Constitution represents this concept of government as an occasionally useful servant, but the eternal enemy of liberty, in trying to use the power of law to constrain this enemy of our liberty into serving our liberty. In order to accomplish this, of course, you have to have you have to have the government ruled by law, and you have to have a reasonably intelligent and moral population. So there's been this effort to subvert our intelligence as a people, and this effort to subvert our morality, and both of those efforts, unfortunately, have been very successful. Nonetheless, there is this residuum in the population of people who do remember, perhaps from lessons that they learned at the knees of very good parents, because they wouldn't learn these things in our government school system, they do remember what the United States was like under the glorious Constitution. And it is an imperfect document. You know, I would have done away with a couple of things. I wouldn't have included the eminent domain provision, and I think I probably wouldn't have permitted Congress to suspend habeas corpus. But these blemishes notwithstanding, it does represent the zenith of political philosophy as applied to the effort to preserve human freedom and human history. It is a priceless document. It's a priceless blessing. It's one of those things that is more often invoked than understood and more often observed in the breach than in compliance. But nonetheless, as long as we have that document, that banner to repair to, there is hope for the preservation or the restoration, better stated, of our freedoms.
I agree with you totally. Our guest this evening has been William Grieg. And of course, we've been talking really about the attack on the fundamentals of our nation, about Stephen Breyer. I think that we should have a new law so that they could really get those people who are potential terrorists or a threat to the state, so they can be incorporated and lose their constitutional rights. We're in real trouble, but fascinating program. Good night. Talk to you later. Bye-bye.
God bless.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and I hope you've enjoyed our conversation with William Grieg, certainly one of the more brilliant commentators we have, and we're privileged to have him as a guest here at Radio Liberty. We do hope that many of you would give serious consideration to helping Radio Liberty. We're rather unique. I think that we're the only part of the alternative media that brings together the political and the spiritual and points out that there really is another spiritual dimension, that there really are forces working within secret societies that are intent upon changing our structure of government. They're the reason for the things that are happening today. And until you understand that we are involved in a spiritual battle being fought on a political, ideological, cultural, financial, economic battlefield, none of the things going on make sense. Once you understand the spiritual component, why it all makes sense. That's why our book, The Brotherhood of Darkness, our talk on the Forbidden Secret, that's a DVD and comes with a syllabus if you want it, why that is so vitally important. So we do hope that many of you out there will, if you're able, will give serious consideration to joining the Radio Liberty family of supporters or helping us in whatever way you can so we can maintain our network of almost 60 outlets every single week as we reach out by satellite, by shortwave, by radio, by internet, and touch people's hearts and minds, and a lot of them listen to us, and they think we're crazy to begin with, and after a while they're afraid we're not. But we have an opportunity, and you can become part of our team if you'd like. Our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. Oh, if you're interested in a gift for someone, why, the Freedom Documents put together by Pastor Chuck Baldwin are an excellent thing to have. It's got everything from the Mayflower Compact to George Washington's Farewell Address and the Gettysburg Address and so many of the vital documents that you need to know and understand. And Chuck put them together, Chuck Baldwin, Pastor Chuck Baldwin, and we carry them. Something, there are about 50 of them, 50 different documents that you need to have at your fingertips. And, of course, a wonderful gift, Christmas gift at this time. We have a four-tape set called The Foundations of Our Freedom. To understand what the Supreme Court has done, why, two books. One was my book, Brotherhood of Darkness. And let me just mention also Behind the Lodge Door and Unholy Alliance by James Wardner, two other books. I'll go into the impact of the secret societies on our court system and our Supreme Court. But to see how it's all played out, the book Betrayed by the Bench by our good friend John Stormer is must reading for anybody who wants to understand what's going on today. Go to our website at RadioLiberty.com. You can watch our DVDs, you can listen to our programs, you can pull down our newsletters, and please feel free to do that. And get the information and check the facts out and look at the source of references. And we have a lot of the original documents which we make available through Radio Liberty for you. We ask you, of course, to encourage others to listen to our programs. We ask you to certainly try to get to your family and your friends and make them understand the spiritual forces which are at work behind the scenes. And we are on the verge of losing this wonderful country. Believe me, I've been at this battle for 45 years, and we are at that final point today. And the question is, who will survive? Who will, who will prevail? Well, of course, we will not, you and I, be able to do that on our own. Only God can do that if we are worthy of His help and support. So understand what's going on. Pray for America and pray for revival. Pray for our leaders and our ministers, but please pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and for our protection. Remember our number. It's 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. Once again, our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, our website, RadioLiberty.com. Until tomorrow evening at the same time, may the Lord be with you.